everybody. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host. And as usual, I'm here with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle.
Hey, everyone.
It's good to be here.
All right. So the conference is coming up. Registration is just really strong. We're very happy about that. It's just around the corner now, March 4th and 5th. You can still get your tickets. So make sure you go to apologeticscanadaconference.com, click on Abbotsford, and then get your tickets as soon as you can before space runs out. One of the speakers that I'm looking forward to hearing from is Dr. Timothy Mulhoff. And I think that's how his name is pronounced. His last name is really...
Yeah, I always want to say Mulhoff, but...
I believe it's Mulhoff. Yeah, he wrote a great book with J.P. Moreland called God Conversations, I believe.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny and just apropos for making illustrations.
It's a great book to think through illustrations, you know, to help in that way. And he's a great thinker, great communicator. And in fact, Biola University, he is their favorite chapel speaker. Like at Biola, like, you know, when it comes to speakers, like, he reigns supreme.
Which is a lot to say considering it's Biola and it's heavy hitters as far as the eye can see, right?
Right, yeah. And they've had a lot, they have a lot of great people to pull from. So that's really saying something.
You know, I mean, he's his professor of communications. And that always kind of, I guess if I were professor of communications of some sort, I just the tremendous amount of pressure that I would feel.
There's a lot of weight on you.
Yeah. Every time you talk to somebody, you know that you're being tested, right?
It's so, like the professor of preaching, right? Whenever you go preach, you know, it's a lot to live up to.
Yeah. I remember him saying that research shows that in communication, when you finish a conversation, you forget half the things that were said. And then I think like a day later or something like that, you only remember, you forget like 80% of what you heard. But the kinds of things that you will likely remember are the illustrations that you heard, examples that were given, and things like that. So he's going to talk about things like that. So if you are looking for a way to improve your communication skills with your friends, be they Christians or people who hold some other worldview, come and check him out at the Apologetics Canada Conference, March 4th and 5th. He is the... He has one breakout session at 12:30 on Saturday, and then his main session will be at 2:30. He's the last, but certainly not the least, speaker. So come check us out.
He's batting cleanup.
So, Chris, what have you found for us this week?
This week I came across an article where John Cleese, famous from Fawlty Towers and the Monty Python. Nice.
Whoa there.
Steve, come back.
Steve just took off on his horse. It's just a flesh wound.
See you later.
but man, you have no arms.
That's my favorite. Yeah. That's the favorite.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Unchal pas. What are you going to do? Bleed on me?
Oh, man. Monty Python.
So John Cleese.
John Cleese. He is disappointed with the state of our society in the West right now. And particularly, he is upset. Maybe upset isn't a good word. I think I'm just going to stick with disappointed. He's disappointed in the fact that he will no longer be able to, or feels as though it would be good for him to go on to university campuses, college campuses, and give talks precisely because of the whole idea of safe zones, like these safe places that
trigger
people are creating,
warnings
and
political
all
correctness.
Political correctness. That people, he feels that, and his quote is, or I'll paraphrase it, but that key to comedy is critique, is being critical of something. And not necessarily, not cruel, but being critical. And it's a keystone to comedy. And if he can't do that, because he feels that people are now becoming more and more incapable of handling that sort of thing, that he won't bother. He's actually been warned off because his comedy is too... And if you know John Cleese, the guy keeps it pretty clean. right? Mm-hmm. He's not overly offensive. I find him hysterical. Mm-hmm. But yet now his comedy is gone too far.
Right. For whatever, the, for whatever the university too far campus. Means.
Yeah. For the university. I mean, for the common person. But this is why I think people, when we talk about a lot, I know, Andy, you mention this all the time, about how the university campus is a whole, is a different animal, mm-hmm. right? And this is where a lot of ideas and stuff like that are coming out. But if you spend time on them or read about what's going on in them, it's incredible the way it's going. And this is the sort of the leaders of our society, right, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been interesting to me to watch the U.S. Presidential race, you know, with these guys jostling for position and watching Trump in the middle of all this. Because really, he's just a bull in a china shop, right? Like when it comes to political correctness, he's like, oh, that's political. You know, he just smashes it. And so it's kind of interesting to me that you have a lot of people who just like, you know, they don't really care about his political views. They just love the fact that he's not politically correct.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think because you have this, you know, kind of polarization that's happening in our culture today where you got some people, a lot of people who are hyper politically correct. And then you got others who are just fed up with it.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have this, you know, John Cleese here, he just like, well, throws his hands up in the air and he's like, oh, I'm done. Right.
Yeah.
But then you got guys like Trump who are like, well, I'm just going to smash it. Right. And people are loving that. It's interesting to me, the kind of like the parallels between Hitler and Trump in the sense that during Germany after World War One, the German people just felt defeated and annoyed with all the sanctions that they had placed on them. And they were just frustrated. And here was somebody who came along and just smashed the political correctness.
Strong nationalist attitude.
Yep, strong nationalist attitude. And really just spoke what the people felt, you know. And they didn't care about his political views, right? He was speaking their language and they appreciated what he was saying. And he didn't get a majority vote, but because it was the divided nation, it was enough to win.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to me that you see a very similar thing taking place right now in U.S. politics. People are just so fed up with the way politics have been done. I mean, because as you watch the news, I mean, political correctness is just rife in what's going on right now.
It's huge.
And it has huge implications for free speech. Right?
Yeah, and that's where this all comes to, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, exactly, because this is the antecedents, if you will, of future sanctions and such that are going to be, that seem to be in the works of coming down towards us not being able to say what we want because it's deemed offensive. And I mean, this is already happening. Mm-hmm. But you can sort of see, and he likens it to 1984, the George Orwell book, fantastic book. But this idea of you becoming more and more and more censored with what you can say, even with what you can think, right? You can't think out loud anymore, have opinions if they're unsafe, quote unquote, unsafe for other people.
Do you want to give us just a very quick summary of 1984? I mean, you mentioned censorship.
Yeah. Essentially, 1984. It's been quite a number of years since I've read it, but the main character is they're part of a society that it's essentially everybody has their place. It's almost like I always looked at it as like a very strong Marxist sort of society. But everybody, there's police or ministries, I believe they're called, and you're not allowed to buck the system. So everybody goes to work and does their thing, and there's one character in particular that starts to have these sort of factional or out of bounds thinking thoughts and he starts asking questions. So he starts talking to people and he starts to find other people that are sort of in that vein as well. And it kind of keeps going. I don't want to spoil it, but essentially that it ends. I found the ending incredibly depressing myself, but I won't say what happens, but at any rate, that's it. It's just a very strong society where you're not allowed to think or to go outside the company line. It's very strong nationalist, and they have these.
So in other words, you have thought police.
Thought police, exactly.
Yeah.
This is kind of the whole, you know, the intolerance of tolerance kind of thing going on right now that people are rightly frustrated with. And, you know, right now there are just certain topics that you just in our culture you just can't disagree on. Like homosexuality, for example. Gender all of a sudden has become one.
Right.
You know, animal rights is another one. You know, there's Islam, another one.
Sorry, I was going to say the sad thing is race is getting tied up in this, and I agree about the race thing, right? But they've made them the same thing. Hmm. That's the problem.
It's all built on faulty logic, and so it all gets intertwined into it. Like that's the problem. There's a lot of just ridiculous logic that goes in with all this.
The idea of tolerance, as at least as the sort of the culture at large understands it today, it's
disagreement. You can't even disagree.
That's exactly it. It's not tolerance anymore, because tolerance means that you disagree.
Tolerate.
But you tolerate. Exactly. You accept the person, but you disagree on your beliefs.
Such as homosexuality. We tolerate homosexuality. You might disagree with it, but you're not trying to stop people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not writing laws, nor would I want to see laws in effect that are stopping people from, you know, practicing homosexuality. I mean, that's what they're doing, you know, like that's what they're going to do. I mean, nobody's trying to stop that. But take, for example, pedophilia. Well, we're not tolerant of pedophilia. We will write laws. We will do things to stop pedophiles.
Yeah, because it's wrong.
Because it's wrong. Yeah. Now I still think homosexuality is wrong.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I should phrase it differently.
Yeah, but I'm not going to try to stop them, right? I mean, you got two adults. That's what they want to do. I think it's within the bounds of the law.
Yeah, it's freedom to sin, right?
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, even take adultery, for example. It's not against the law to commit adultery. But yet I'm flipping it, right?
Yep.
But I still think adultery is wrong. But yet at the same time, people are free to, you know, commit adultery. I mean, we're not policing that. We're not, you know, intolerant of even adultery, if that makes sense.
Should we police that? I'm just playing the devil's advocate here.
With adultery?
Yeah.
I've heard.
Or things like, I guess I'm the kind of question
the Catholic Church tried.
Yeah.
And they burned a number of people in the process.
I guess the question that I'm raising is, okay, pedophilia, homosexuality, one, you wouldn't have problem policing. The other, you would. So I guess I'm just wondering what the difference is, why you're drawing that line there.
That's an interesting question, because I've heard arguments from solely a pragmatic reasons towards wanting to police things like adultery and homosexuality, because they're anti-propagation, or they don't propagate the species, right? It's harder for society continue to sustain itself if it allows things like adultery and homosexuality, because that's anti-family in a sense, right?
Anti-procreation.
Exactly. So I was using that in a traditional sense, the word family. Thank you for pointing that out. But at the same time, I still don't think that it's even possible to.
The problem is what are you losing in the process?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you begin to police certain things and you begin to lose your freedom.
Exactly. And that's where you start getting 1984.
Exactly. And now you have to ask yourself, well, what's more valuable here? My freedom, or are we going to police all these things? Now we've already come from, you know, history's rife with examples of trying to police various things, and history's full of where that led us. I mean, in many ways, that's what the Enlightenment is all about, right? I mean, in many ways, the Enlightenment came about because the politics and the church were, you know, in bed together, and they were doing all kinds of stuff that were imposing on people's freedom. And in their frustration, really, they began to try to, you know, weed God out of culture, right? And you get secularism, right? Which was a powerful force against the church to try to, you know, to end the monopoly of what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, because, like, for example, by the way, that's an interesting parallel with John Cleese, is, you know, the John Cleese of the Enlightenment was Voltaire. And, you know, and he used comedy, he used satire against the powers that be, right? But they didn't allow that, and he went to jail for it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the people loved him, you know, for that. But, you know, because at the time, you didn't have that freedom of speech. Mm. Ultimately, ultimately, I forgot what I was going to say with that.
Well, I think at the end of the day, though, and I think this leads to what you're saying, is we're now entering into another time like that, except it's been flipped. And now the free people are now imposing, because of this concept of the new tolerance,
free people in quotation marks,
in quotation, right? Yeah, sorry, I was doing quotation marks. the free people are imposing sanctions on other people and condemning their speech, and
which is taking away their freedom.
Exactly, which is, it's so ironic. And the interesting thing about this is I heard a quote where it says that people who can't control their own emotions will then try to control the behavior of other people. Mm-hmm. People who can't control their emotions will try to control the behavior of other people. And this is what we're seeing, is I call this the pansification of the West, where mm-hmm. people have become less and less capable of owning how they feel, right? And right. Our relationships are broken because we don't know how to get into deep, meaningful relationships and know
and
what our emotions.
Allow for disagreements.
And allow for disagreements, because that's one of the things. Like, we as a team, we can disagree with each other, but we'll talk it out, right, guys? Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to be getting after. But in the society, and particularly on the campuses now, we're not seeing that. So we're seeing sort of destructive behavior and things coming down the pipe.
Speaking of sort of the sacred cows of our society that you're not really allowed to touch, one thing comes to mind, and that's evolution. Now, Andy, yeah. you wrote an article on that.
Yeah, we're in a series right now called, was it Really Bad Arguments?
The worst apologetic arguments ever.
Yeah, worst apologetic arguments ever. And this one might surprise people, and this is a bit of a hot topic button. I mean, really, this is the politically correct one of Christianity, it seems, these days. You know, can you talk about evolution? So we're going to. For many years, I held to a, so let me just say this right off the bat, just to pique people's interest. I'm going to argue that evolution is one of the worst apologetic arguments, particularly for the existence of God. And I say that as somebody that's experienced it. For many years, I had a belief that I think a lot of people share or can appreciate. And that is that I had this belief that if evolution was ever proven true, that it means that God doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But if evolution could be proven false, that it would mean God does exist. And so let me just take a moment to define what I mean by evolution, because here's a term that just gets abused.
It's really slippery.
Yeah.
What does William Lane Craig call it? An accordion word?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it can be stretched out and... Yeah. Yeah.
So let me just, in really basic terms, you're kind of talking out both sides of your mouth in one sense with evolution, because on the one hand, I believe that evolution is true in a no-brainer kind of way when we're looking at a micro, that people often say, like a micro evolution. Can things change in small ways over time? And the answer to that is absolutely. We see it happening. We can even do it with, you know, selective breeding of dogs or whatever it may be. I mean, we've seen it with the Galapagos Islands, you know, like with beak sizes and other things. Like, mm-hmm. you can get small change over time. I mean, clearly that happens. If anything, I would say, like, this is just part of the wonderful way that God created us, is that we have adaptability, mm-hmm. right? Now, that's a different question, though, than is macroevolution possible. And so when I use the word evolution, and most Christians use the word evolution, they mean macroevolution. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we have to be careful, though, where Christians got to be careful to define their terms here, because this is where other people kind of hear from the outside and go, man, Christians are so stupid, right? Because it's like, clearly evolution's true, right. You know, but yeah. they're thinking, you know, they're putting it all together, whereas we're parsing this out. Yeah, they're including micro. We're parsing it out and saying that, no, it doesn't seem to me that macro evolution is possible, that large change over time is possible.
So
or
in other words, you know, one species turning into another species.
Like a sponge to a bat or...
Right, so,
right, or a wolf-like creature to a whale. Like,
right. So when we're talking about microevolution, another phrase for that is descent with modification. And macroevolution is just common descent, the idea that we all came from this one, whatever, amoeba.
Right.
Right? That kind of branched out into all these different species.
And that's where everything, came from. And so the other thing, though, that you have to include into microevolution is a more robust understanding of neo-Darwinism. Mm-hmm. And by that, we're just talking about the new Darwinism. And by that, we mean that when Darwin came up with his theory of origin of species, he wasn't taking into account a robust understanding of genetics. Mm-hmm. And particularly genetic modification through mutation. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So that these things can take place through genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. So what happens then is in neo-Darwinism, which is kind of a more robust understanding of evolution, really it's this belief then that everything, every aspect of life, not just all the species, but everything that we understand, even consciousness, everything, all evolved. Mm-hmm. And so there's literally absolutely no room for God in this model.
Right.
So ultimately, so now that kind of helps to, I think, to define what we're talking about here. So as you can imagine then, as I went along in my faith, and I'm curious if you guys have experienced this as well, where you kind of looked at things and you thought, okay, you know, when I saw evidence against evolution, that strengthened my faith. And when I saw evidence for evolution, macro, what I'm talking about here, neo-Darwinism, then that weakened my faith. And in many ways, I personally had a belief that if it was ever determined, if the scales ever tipped towards macroevolution, that I needed, you know, take out the sacred knife, you know, and I needed to, you know, kill my faith on the altar.
I don't know. Have you felt that, Chris?
Certainly. Yeah. And I want to be careful how I word this, because I mean no disrespect or whatever. But when I came into the faith, I came in as a recovery guy, right? Came out of the history of addictions. And there wasn't always the most educated biblically and all that stuff, people that would come and talk to us, right? So people often wouldn't be thinking through super well some of these things. And so I would hear that all the time. People would essentially put evolution and God on par with one another. And if evolution is true, then God doesn't exist. I was told this repeatedly. So I had that exact view. And so I would fight vehemently against that. I was, you know, I very close-minded to that discussion, because in my mind, the way I had been taught is that was that sort of false dichotomy, right?
Yeah. If you wanted to adopt evolution, you had to kill your faith.
Exactly.
I guess for me, my upbringing has been a little bit different. So I never really quite felt that tension. I grew up in a Roman Catholic church, and I found that a lot of Roman Catholics, for them, the tension isn't as great. And in fact, when
I think that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, the theory of evolution came out, I think the Roman Catholic Church and
there wasn't a big divide.
No,
a lot of people
really
don't know that, yeah. that people weren't up in arms about evolution when it first came out.
You do see that kind of tension, though, in especially in evangelical circles on the Protestant side, especially in the evangelical circles. And I never really had that. And so growing up, I guess part of the reason was when I'm reading Genesis, I have the tendency to read it more in the metaphorical sense or in the more literary side of things rather than, okay, this is what Genesis is trying to tell me exactly, 6 days, the mechanics of creation and things like that. I never really had that understanding, so it wasn't that big.
Well, that's the problem, I think, is that a lot of people want to marry evolution with Genesis, and then that's where I think that they're coming up with this dichotomy that, you know, if you want to adopt evolution, you know, there's no room for God there.
It's one or
he takes out
one or the other.
But he's gone.
But then one day I began to realize how ridiculous this argument is, particularly because I had the flip side of this argument as well. So I figured if I could convince an atheist that evolution wasn't true, well, then the opposite would be true. They would suddenly become a theist. Right, because I would suddenly become an atheist if the reverse were so. Well, then I started reading these different scientists and philosophers that were raising serious concerns over neo-Darwinism, particularly right now Thomas Nagel, Raymond Tallis. I mean, there's a list that are serious, that have some serious concerns with
and
it.
And these are not just, you know, your random.
Oh, these are top-notch philosophers and scientists. Yeah. But they're not becoming theists. So they may have problems with neo-Darwinism. And a lot of people thought, oh, man, if we could just, you know, debunk it, they'll become theists. No, they're not. You know, because it's a terrible argument. They're just looking for alternative explanations. They're not just suddenly becoming theists. And I began to realize, you know, early on in my college years, that maybe I've got this all wrong.
Hmm.
Like, maybe I've been thinking about this all wrong. And I began to realize evolution is an argument of how. It's right. not an argument of who. And that is a big distinction. And what I began to realize is that if evolution was true, that could have been the way God chose to create.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, who am I to say how God can and can't bring about people? I mean, maybe that's how he did it. But literally, it says nothing to who did it, right? It doesn't say, you know, on neo-Darwinism, of course, they're going to say, well, it has to be chance. But again, I mean, you could look at that from different angles and go, well, maybe God made it. I mean, you could take like a Voltaire kind of understanding of it and go, well, it's just a wound up, you know, watch, right? And he just set it into motion, step back, but it was all part of his plan. I mean, again, it would say nothing about theism. It would only talk about, you know, how. It wouldn't talk about the who. And this began to get me to rethink this whole argument. And really, in the article, I was talking about how I kind of got my faith off of life support, because my faith constantly felt like it was on a ventilator, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
or that periodically I had to take the intelligent design, you know, defibrillator paddles, right, and kind of jolt my faith back with these different arguments that I could find.
Yeah,
and I want listeners to understand, like, listen, I just truthfully, I just don't even care about it anymore. I read up on evolution now and then, and I see where the arguments are at these days, and I'm quite happy to let, you know, science work its way out and you know, see where these things go. I think that people might find this interesting. As I've studied the issue, I still think macroevolution is false. I do not see the evidence for it, and I have studied it quite a bit, and I've read and heard from a number of atheists and theists on it, and I just do not see the evidence for macroevolution, and particularly, you know, neo-Darwinism. I do not see the evidence for it, but I don't see the scientific evidence for it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm inclined to believe that it's not true for scientific reasons, not for theological reasons, and particularly not because I've got this bad understanding of an argument for God's existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people need to think more about that. As I look at it, I can't see how you could make it into an argument for God's existence. I think you could make it into an argument to show that there's, you know, perhaps design. But even then, I mean, you've got theists that are evolutionists,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some well-known evangelicals hold to it.
Francis Collins being one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Even Timothy Keller leans that way, mm-hmm. Which I think upsets a lot of people in the Gospel Coalition. Right. But it's like, yeah, those guys might lean that way, and you got other guys that are leaning far against it, and that's because it's an argument of how, not who. And that's why in Christianity you can have people, you know, in both camps. Now, I get it where evangelicals get concerned about this whole thing for implications like you were bringing, Steve.
Right.
What does it say about Genesis? What does it say about the historicity of Adam? I think that those are all valid and important questions that need to get worked out, and I'm not undermining those. But we at least need to get the argument straight of what we're looking at. And particularly, I think we need to be careful that we're not setting up our young people for a fall when they head into university.
Exactly.
That they don't have the freedom to look at the evidence where it goes, or at least that they don't have, you know, the sacrificial knife, you know, hovering over the heartbeat of their faith, ready to kill it at any moment,
mm-hmm.
because as they're studying the evidence. Does that make sense?
Total mm-hmm. sense. Yeah. Absolutely. For me, I still have a lot of friends that really hold on tight to this. And my encouragement to them is just to relax, as you're mentioning, Andy, and chill out, because often I'll hear them say things that really just don't make sense. And it troubles me, because I know that it's going to be difficult for them to convince people on the outside looking in that they're reasonable, because what they're saying isn't reasonable. But also, as you said, as far as the children are concerned, right? We must think of the children, right? sorry, it's Simpsons, but we have to think about them and what we're setting them up for and get them to understand where the argument or where does the conflict really lie, right? And this is Alvin Plantinga.
Which is a great book. Where does the conflict really lie?
Exactly. And it doesn't lie in does God exist or not exist based on evolution.
Mm-hmm. It lies in the area of physicalism, in fact.
Yep.
Right.
And that's a much more fundamental question that gets to the very heart of a design argument. You know, and so, because I think people want to lump evolution into a design argument. And I just, now, maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't see how it can fall into a design argument.
No. Mm-hmm.
It's a how argument. It's not a who.
Right. All right. Well, that's a good note to end on. We had some really precious nuggets. Pansification of the West and Voltaire being the John Cleese of Enlightenment.
I've never heard that. That's good.
That's actually really good. Yeah. And we talked about evolution and how it's a question of how, not who. Keep those things in mind and keep thinking. And we'll come back next week with more. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a Ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week.